All right. Good morning, everyone. I call this meeting of the House Sustainable Infrastructure Policy Committee for March 6, 2024 to order. A quorum is present, so we will get started. First, can I get a motion to approve the minutes from February 21st, 2024?
So moved.
All right. So moved. All of those in favor of approval of the minutes, say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed? All right. Minutes are approved. Let's see. First, we have today we're going to mark up and vote out House File 4025. As a reminder, we will not be taking any further public testimony on this bill today. And with that, Chair Cagle, would you like to move your bill?
Thank you, Chair. I will move House File 4025 to State Government Finance.
All right. And Chair, I see you have the A3 Authors Amendment. Would you like to move your amendment and explain what it does?
Yes. So the A3 Amendment incorporates a lot of changes that we've had discussions about from members. And so we got the fiscal note back. And so the this year's or the costs were inserting the numbers in the dot, dot, dots and then adding the base. On page three, line three, we are removing the independent agency of state government and putting in statute language of the infrastructure council that we've created. Line four, we are deleting the qualifications and inserting the words appointment requirements. And then page four, line five, we are inserting direct and practical experience. Then on the appointing piece, so if you go to voting or on the appointing piece, we are changing it so that each of the appointers has to have a appoint one member from the metro area and one member from greater Minnesota. Then we are kind of cleaning up some language around that. Around on line 16 on page four, we are making sure that we are getting representation from the public and private sectors. And then part of the other language that we're inserting in page six is making sure that we're analyzing methods to improve efficiency and the resources related to public infrastructure and public asset management. That's really just kind of like we want to make sure that they're doing an inventory of the current practices that are already out there and coordinating them because there's a lot of these current practices that are out there, but a lot of organizations don't know about them. And then also making sure that we're reducing duplication. And so that if one organization has this great tool, we can use that instead of trying to, coordinate, that we can coordinate across the departments, across agencies, and then make sure that we are also identifying gaps in that asset management. And then just kind of, here we go. Information on existing asset management tools is on line 24. So making sure that we're doing that inventory. And then and then putting a little bit more of descriptions around the executive director must have leadership and management experience and training and experience in public works or asset management. That came as a suggestion by Representative Anderson to make sure that we're getting folks that have practical experience to be the ones running the organization. So with that, I will move the A3 amendment.
All right. And we have member discussion of the A3 amendment. Representative Anderson.
Thank you to the chair. A little confusing. Maybe I missed something here. We're working on the A3, but there's also a DE1. Is that changing the entire bill, or when is that going to be?
That's not my amendment.
Oh, okay.
That's mine.
Okay.
We'll get there.
My question.
Yep. Any other member discussion on the A3? All right. Seeing no further discussion, Chair Cagle, I assume you renew your motion to adopt the A3 amendment.
Yes.
All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? Motion prevails. All right, Representative Cagle, please tell us about your bill.
Well, I think what we are trying to do here, you know, one of the things that I think about is why is this important? And, you know, with all the federal money that's coming in, I want to make sure that we're using that money wisely and that we're not duplicating projects, that we're coordinating so that if there are projects happening in the same area, that they can coordinate the labor. And so that's really going to, you know, save our state a lot of money when it comes to these infrastructure projects. And so that's really, you know, the main goal of this is to have some sort of long-term vision for infrastructure planning. And that's really just kind of gets down to the heart of the issue. And so I think we kind of walked through the bill previously. So I think everybody has a pretty good understanding of the bill.
All right. And before we go to member discussion on the bill as amended, we have two other pre-filed amendments. Representative Franzen, would you like to move the DE1 amendment?
Yes, DE1 amendment is mine. Representative
Anderson. Could you pull your mic closer?
Oh, my.
Thank you so much.
Okay, so. Yes. Let me just bring up my little information here on the forecast. MMB, I have a file called MMB. Okay, so members, here's what I'm thinking. We have a fiscal note that's pretty egregious in a time that we are facing a, what they call a structural imbalance. CBS News on February 29th had a quote from Aaron Campbell, the commissioner of Minnesota MMB, that said, projections show revenues will not keep pace with spending in the next budget cycle, creating a structural imbalance of $1.5 billion for fiscal years 26 and 27. She emphasized that the current surplus that we had of the $3 billion, 3.1, whatever it was, can mitigate that. However, she emphasized that the current surplus can mitigate that, but the balance could lead to a potential deficit down the line if lawmakers aren't careful. In order to protect the investments that are made in programs that serve Minnesotans, it will be important that policymakers exercise caution in enacting additional ongoing spending this legislative session. So, article continues, if the legislature doesn't spend any of the surplus on supplemental budget items this year, the money will carry over and provide another surplus cushion. But anything they spend this year will mean less money on the bottom line when lawmakers in January craft the next two-year budget. Members, we should take this very seriously. Every single dollar that we spend this legislative cycle puts us further and further into the hole. And I don't know about you, but I have no desire to come into the next legislative cycle and have to tell people we have to cut their budgets. And no way can Minnesotans afford another tax increase after they just had taxes raised in this state by over $10 billion. So members, this amendment simply makes a study. Representative Cagle has done good work. She has worked very hard on this bill. Her heart is in the right places. But I do not think that this bill is needed at this time. The fiscal note breaks down some costs. So for fiscal year 25, for 0.17 full-time employees, $192,000. Fiscal year 26, $653,000 for 2.75 full-time employees. Fiscal year 27, $768,000 for 3 full-time employees. That is a total of $1.421 million from the general fund in fiscal year 25 and fiscal year through fiscal year 27. The cost to MMB just to process reimbursements and per diems to the members in fiscal year 25 is $56,000. Fringe benefits to employees cost 32% of the salary. And the employee overhead costs are 17.17% of total salary and fringe costs. Now, the fiscal note also says that the new council would need 2,000 square foot office space. So that is about, break it down to $57,500 per year. We have admin smart services for $50,000 a year, hard-walled office to $30,000 to $100,000, or $20,000 for a modular office, a large conference room to hold 29. The cost of the conference room is estimated to be $80,000 unless use of existing Capitol complex rooms, a conference table for $45,000, technology for the conference room $20,000, 29 chairs at $650, or a total of $18,850. I don't know about you, but my constituents aren't buying $650 chairs these days. We have per diems at $3,000 per meeting, mileage at $1,327 per meeting, lunch at $2,028 per meeting. I don't know about you, but I brought my lunch today. I made a nice little pasta with feta. If any of you have seen the TikTok feta, that's what I'm having today with chicken. And then we have the executive director is estimated to make $78.08 per hour with fringe benefits and overhead costs of $251,375 per year, which in fiscal year 27 forward is $200,052.342. We have an agency chief financial officer estimated at $61.10 per hour, which is with fringe benefits and overhead costs, $147,532. The deputy director, which is estimated at $63.25 an hour, fringe benefits and overhead, $152,723. Now, I was also doing a little investigating on the LinkedIn and came across this lovely gentleman who has been in our bonding committee named Micah Intermill. He is already doing this work. There is a job, there is an application for, if you go onto his website, there is an application for somebody to help him in this role. So we are already doing this without this bill. I had some screenshots saved on my computer, but I didn't realize we were going to get to the DE1, my amendment, as quickly as we did, because otherwise I would read that off too. But I think you can look up Micah Intermill's little LinkedIn page there, super easy to do, and hopefully that job is still listed there. But if not, I can find the screenshots later on. But members, we do not need to spend this kind of money at this important time in the legislative session. We have nursing homes that are still underfunded. We have disability services that are still underfunded. We have schools in this state that I thought were fully funded. In Minneapolis alone, they're cutting $300 million from their budgets. We have teachers in this state that are going without any pay raises in their contract.
And Rep. Franzen, if we could wrap up so that we can get through this DE1.
I would encourage a vote of no on the DE1. Thank you.
Right. Thank you. Chair Cagle, response to DE1.
Thank you, Chair.
I would encourage a yes vote. A yes vote on the DE1. Yes, vote.
Well, I concur with Representative Franzen that we should vote no on this. one thing is that this is not a finance committee, but I do I appreciate you reading off the fiscal note because I also think it's a little bit kind of ridiculous. And so the fiscal note, you know, they put a range of the salary or expected cost. And then they take the highest one, and that's what they put in the fiscal note. So I think they are kind of overestimating what the needs of the office will be. As far as Micah, his job is not the same. His job is to literally just look for the federal funds and help cities find the federal funds, because I actually, that was my bill last year, and so I created that federal funds coordinator office, and then having conversations with Micah about if he would want to transition that role into this, and he looked at it and just said that it's not the same. And MMB wants to keep that role within their office so that they can continue to coordinate those federal funds.
All right. Any member discussion on the DE1? Keeping in mind, we'll keep it to the DE1 language. All right. Rep. Franzen.
Yeah. Can we get a roll call for this amendment? And members, again,
please vote yes on the DE1.
We're having a tough time this morning, aren't we all?
Okay. All right. Representative Franson requests a roll call. We didn't have any further member discussion on the DE1. Okay. Representative Franson requests a roll call on the DE1. The clerk will take the roll.
Chair Cagle?
No.
Vice Chair Curran?
No.
Lead Franson?
Yes.
Representative Acom?
No.
Representative Anderson?
Anderson, aye.
Representative Clardy?
No.
Representative Gilman?
Yes.
Representative Hornstein?
No.
Representative Igo?
Yes.
Representative Kraft?
No.
Representative Ream?
No.
Representative Schultz?
Schultz, aye.
Representative Smith?
No.
All right. With 5 ayes and 8 nays, the motion does not prevail. The amendment is not adopted. All right. Now we are moving on to the second pre-filed amendment. Would the member offering the A2 amendment like to move the amendment and explain what it does?
So moved, Chair. The A2 amendment is a very simple amendment. It's going to be on page 3, line 9. We are going to be striking the clause of 2 members appointed by the governor. And I know Chair Cagle and I had a lot of conversation on this. I still wanted to move this amendment today because I think it's really important for precedent of this chamber and this committee. I understand that when we create these kinds of task forces and councils, that they need to be located somewhere in the executive branch in one of those committees. However, I don't like the precedent of giving the governor approval to add voting members to that board. I think that just as a chamber, we need to make sure and keep the legislative authority here in this chamber where people are electing every single one of us to come here and sit in these chairs and do business. The governor being able to choose who they see fit, I just think is a bad optic. And if we continue down that path as a legislature, we're going to continue to export the power of the legislature away and do rulemaking and agencies. And I don't think that's what any Minnesotan wants, regardless of party. So I think this would be a good step for us today to vote yes on this amendment, remove the governor's appointees, and make this bill a little better. Thank you.
All right. Chair Cagle, any response to the A2?
Thank you, Chair. And I know we've had conversations about this, so, mm-hmm. You know, not a big surprise to you. But with the 3 branches of government, we actually have to make sure that all 3 are represented in order for it to be constitutional. And I know that, you know, it living with within the executive branch has given some folks some heartburn, and we have been looking for a place to house it that would make sense, that is still constitutional. And so I know that, you know, this, we want this to be an independent board. And so, you know, that's our goal. And I really hope that, you know, any of the authority that you know, we removed the EO, the recommendations for the EO as well, for the executive order. So I'm hoping that will kind of come to a happy medium there, so that we're not giving the governor direction. And remember, it could be any governor, mm-hmm. You know. And so it comes down to the constitutionality and the 3 party system, or the 3, you know, branches of government. And we got to have it.
Chair.
Oh, yes.
Representative Schultz. Thank you. Representative Cagle, can you point me to the place in the Constitution that says that we need to do it like that? Pointing to constitutionality, and I'd like
sure.
That sourced.
I don't know that off the top of my head. And so I would ask Mr. Burris if he could maybe address that.
Madam Chair, Representative Schultz, I think what I would say just in broad terms is the question that could come up at a constitutional level around executive branch, the authority of the governor in managing the executive branch as a constitutional question, is around separation of powers issues. In this case, as an advisory council, the concerns that might come up are somewhat different because they're advisory in nature. But generally, the principle of separation of powers gives the governor control over management and executive functions in the executive branch.
Thank you, Mr. Burris. And I will note, too, that this is going to state gov, and that's the next stop for this bill.
Yeah, and I think that's, you know, I'm willing to continue to work on language with this bill and make it as, I'm hoping, nonpartisan as possible.
Great. And further member discussion.
Yes.
Rep. Schultz.
Thank you. Representative Cagle, you know, there is the LCC, the Legislative Coordinating Commission, that hosts a host of different commissions, things like this. So there is absolute precedent for this in our current state government. And I think that's been the point that our side has been making during every single committee hearing that we've had this year, that we don't need to be creating a brand new state agency. And so I really call into question your point that this is unconstitutional.
Chair Cagle. Further discussion to the amendment? All right. Seeing no further discussion, Representative Igoe renews the motion to adopt the A2 amendment. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed?
No.
The motion does not prevail. The amendment is not adopted. All right. That is all we have for pre-filed amendments. Members, any discussion to House File 4025 as amended?
No?
All right. Representative Anderson.
Thank you to the chair. I appreciate the work that's been done on the bill. You've really put a lot into this bill and appreciate your effort. But again, kind of piggybacking on what Lead Franzen mentioned, this is a lot of money, and we are in a time when I think both parties have been urged to be cautious in any additional spending we do. We have heard earlier that the committees were going to be getting targets of zero spending for this second year of the biennium. So again, I would just caution members that this bill spends a considerable sum of money on a new commission that some feel might be duplicating state government, and I would encourage members to vote no on this bill.
Right. Representative Gilman.
Thanks, Chair. And thank you so much, Chair Cagle. We've worked a lot on this, and I just want to thank you for being willing to meet and mark up this bill ahead of time. Again, when the fiscal note came in for me as well, it's a sticker shock. And so several times throughout this process, we've heard that this is a voluntary position to be on this council. And so as a volunteer, I don't know of a volunteer that's making 200 and some thousand dollars a year or even six figures a year. So again, I don't want to take away from, you know, thanking staff and, you know, Evelyn for her hard work on the task force and all the stakeholders. There's been great things that I've learned through this process, but I'm also just, and I said it from the beginning, is I did not want this to be another state agency, and I know that we've looked at language and things like that, but anytime that you are giving a wage, you're giving out, you know, insurance, things like that, it's a job, and it's creating another body of government, and it's growing government. So I just want to keep going back to, what is this council going to do? Like, what problem is this council going to solve? That's not already happening in all the different areas of infrastructure throughout the state. I did have several stakeholders reach out as well, going, hey, add me to the list. So people, I think, want to be involved because they don't want to have their expertise and their job not be represented. And I think some folks, you know, can or can't say things on a public level too, because they are state agencies. And so it's discouraging when you put the time and effort into trying to really get a good feel for something, being new, and not seeing that I could get a full answer. Sometimes off the record you can get better answers, which I'm so appreciative of. And the biggest takeaway I have is that I think that we have already amazing people in place throughout the state. We have too much of it, in my opinion. And I think people don't want to have any more mandates, any more regulations that are suggested to the legislature to vote on. And again, that fiscal note should be such a sticker shock that people would go, this is not ready for prime time. This is not ready because we didn't come to create a council that would, again, ding taxpayers for over $1 million, you know. So, unfortunately, I cannot vote for this bill because of the fiscal note and the implied implications of I don't think that we have a problem big enough that this council is going to solve. So, thank you.
Chair Cagle, do you want to respond?
No.
Okay. Representative Schultz.
Hold it for my closing comment.
Thank you, Chair. I would just accentuate the point that's been made by my colleagues so far, and I have a question for Representative Ream. We're looking out to the out years, and we have a bill before us that spends money into the future. Another $1.4 million in the next biennium, and we have a structural imbalance, according to the executive branch. Is this a responsible use of state spending?
And Representative Schultz, I'll say that's we're not going to ask members.
We're in
you can ask me.
Right?
You can yeah right, but you can ask the chair the question.
Chair, this is committee discussion. We are all members of this committee, and we have the ability to debate the bills that are before
us.
Today.
We're not on the floor though, so we cannot ask members to yield in committee. Representative Schultz,
where is that in the committee rules, Chair?
It is in the committee rules.
Please cite where that is in the committee rules.
Representative Schultz.
Please.
Representative Schultz.
Representative Curran, please point to the place.
Representative Schultz, we're going to move on. This is not an act that we do in committee.
I will answer
the question. My hope is that we keep the majority next year so that we can ensure that the state stays in good financial health. I think that's the one thing that we did hear from MMB, is that we are in good shape. We just need to be mindful. And I think that this is actually a thing that makes sense to spend money on, although I do agree the fiscal note is, I think we can do some work on that fiscal note for sure. But, I think that this is really an opportunity. When Michigan did this, they saw job costs reduced from 30 to 40%. I'm curious about those numbers because it seems awfully high, but that's what the MIC told me. And so, I don't know, I think, spending a little money to save a lot of money seems like a good idea. I also wanted to address to the salary is just for the staff. The volunteers don't get paid. They get mileage and per diem just like we did when we were on the task force. And so,
I didn't get per diem.
Oh, you didn't?
No.
Oh.
I asked for it several times. I asked for per diem because I was coming in.
Yeah.
I was not allowed to take per diem one day. So I just want you to know that.
All right. Sure.
Yeah.
Bagel.
But I think,
unfortunately, someone else got per diem, but I did not.
Well, there, and so that's just, it's that, it's the staff salary, and I also do believe that that is high. And so I'm going to be working on the fiscal note, and I'm going to be working with the staff and state government to figure out how we can get that down, because I think it's quite on the high side.
All right, thank you. Chair Cagle, any closing comments?
I kind of think I just said it. I think the problem that is trying to be solved is that we want to make sure that the money coming into the state is used wisely, fiscally responsible, I don't know, fiscally conservative maybe, and that we're really looking at our future, because the more we extend the longevity and efficiency of our systems, the more money we will save as well. And so I just, I know that the fiscal situation this year that we don't have much to spend, but I'm really hoping that I can make the case to the Ways and Means Chair and to leadership that this is a valuable thing to be spending money on. And so with that, I will renew my motion that House File 4025 be referred to State Government Finance as amended.
All right, Representative Franson.
Yes, roll call, please.
All right. Representative Franson requests a roll call on House File 4025 as amended. The clerk will take the roll.
Chair Cagle?
Aye.
Vice Chair Curran?
Aye.
Lead Franson?
No.
Representative Acomb?
Aye.
Representative Anderson?
Anderson, no.
Representative Clardy?
Aye.
Representative Gilman?
No.
Representative Hornstein?
Aye.
Representative Igo?
Igo, no.
Representative Kraft?
Aye.
Representative Ream?
Aye.
Representative Schultz?
Schultz, no.
Representative Smith?
Aye.
With 8 ayes and 5 nays, the motion prevails.
All right, I'm going to hobble up there. Might take me a minute.
Oh, sure. While we get situated here, I will move House File 342 before the committee.
Well, committee, Representative Igo. We'd like to, so we are going to be hearing House File 342. I move that it's before the committee, and the motion is to lay it over. So with that, I will kick it to you, Representative Igo. Go ahead and present your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yes, so the bill in front of us today is a bill around carbon capture and sequestration for the state of Minnesota. It would be to create policy for the state to work to develop these technologies in our state. And this has been a bill I've been working on since I got down here in 2021. And I just kind of want to explain the importance of what it offers and brings our state. One, it's no news that everyone in this committee knows we accepted 2040 goals here last year in this legislature. I'm a firm believer that if we're going to reach those goals, we need to use every single tool we have in our toolbox. Right now, we're not utilizing carbon capture and sequestration, and we need to. If we want to be able to try and reach these goals and do it in a way where we can keep power affordable and we can keep power reliable for every single Minnesotan. Also, it would be a way to make new and enhanced industries in Minnesota. Minnesota's got a vibrant manufacturing, industrial businesses, as well as power capabilities. By implementing this technology, we'd be able to keep some of our existing technologies in place while also making more products that would have a higher demand. For instance, carbon capture and sequestration being attached to all of our steel producing and taconite production process. We'd have carbon negative steel that could be exported from Minnesota. That would attain a lot of the goals that I know all of us in this room share, not to mention some of our other products like out of our agricultural industries. We know that carbon's become a commodity in this modern day and age, whether it be driven by policy, whether it be driven by the consumer. But I do know that this technology exists and that we should be taking steps to use it. I also want to talk about, Minnesota's has the resource and capability. Carbon capture and sequestration can be as simple as replanting a new forest. Carbon capture can also be as intricate as capturing carbon from the atmosphere and pumping it into deep saline aquifers. But Minnesota also has a unique opportunity that's located in northern Minnesota where we've discovered geology that is new and to any other place in the world that they found, where you can pump carbon dioxide underground, and instead of it being turned into like a carbonated water, the carbon interacts with the ground and turns into a solid carbonate, which means there's no monitoring or no tapping of wells. We're the only place in the state that can do, or in the country that can do that. And that's why we've been attracting tens of millions of dollars from the Department of Energy. That's the other point of this legislation. The U of M was given $11 million worth of grants over the next 4 years to study this mineralization that I just talked about. Companies in Minnesota have been given millions of dollars to study carbon capture hubs here. And if we look at the IIJA and the IRA, there's tens of billions of dollars that have put into capture credits that Minnesota could be capturing. We just got done in this committee talking about how we're trying to do everything we can to get those federal dollars before it's too late. The one policy we haven't done anything around in Minnesota is carbon capture and sequestration. The Department of Energy had almost $1 billion flying around out there for states to apply for us to get carbon capture hubs. Minnesota missed out. And who do we miss out to? The oil-producing states, because we have nothing on our books to show that Minnesota is ready to do the work on this technology and try and find ways to use it in other ways. So with that, I appreciate the chance to be able to present this today, and I know I have some testifiers here today, and with that, I'll kind of yield over to them.
Thank you. First up is Brian Cook, and then on deck, John Pollard. Welcome to the committee. If you could just state your name and then proceed with your testimony.
Morning, Chair Cagle and members of the Sustainable Infrastructure Committee. My name is Brian Cook, and I'm the Director of Energy and Elections Policy at the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. Thank you for the opportunity to testify in support of House File 342, Senator Representative Igoe, bill supporting the development and deployment of carbon capture and sequestration technology in Minnesota. The Minnesota Chamber, which represents over 6,300 businesses with over 500,000 employees, believes in the triple goal of affordable, reliable, and cleaner energy. Energy costs are a business input that has generated attention and concern over the past several years as Minnesota's commercial and industrial electrical rates have risen at a much faster rate than the national average. As our state continues its transition towards more renewable sources of energy, carbon capture and sequestration can help play a role as a tool for production of lower carbon emitting power. We hear over and over again from Minnesota businesses that they depend on reliable, safe, and cost-effective power at competitive prices, which is why the Chamber supports the development and deployment of this technology. Without low or no carbon baseload generating resources, our grid's reliability will depend on storage technology that does not currently exist or on the continued use of existing generation facilities. Minnesota has a large menu of low carbon and carbon free options to round out the needs of our grid alongside intermittent and renewable ones. House File 342 will help advance our triple goal of affordable, reliable, and cleaner energy. Thank you for your time this morning.
Thank you. Next up is John Pollard, followed by Kayla Christensen. Welcome to the committee. State your name and proceed with your testimony.
Good morning, Madam Chair. Thank you very much for having me. My name is John Pollard. I'm the Legislative Director for the International Union of Operating Engineers, Local 49. Here in Minnesota, North and South Dakota, we represent about 15,000 men and women who work in the construction industry, specifically on heavy machinery. Our members take great pride in building and maintaining the infrastructure across all sectors of the economy, including emerging technologies in the energy space. Thank you for hearing this bill, Madam Chair. It is an important discussion to be having in front of committees such as this. And thank you for the opportunity to testify in favor of House File 342 relating to carbon capture projects. Carbon capture is a key technology in reducing greenhouse gas emissions and a useful tool to help decarbonize our environment. This legislation doesn't change environmental review policies or the permitting processes. It simply recognizes the importance of carbon capture efforts. It's a reasonable and responsible approach to consider if we are serious about reducing the state's carbon footprint. For my members, it's also an additional help to creating not only just environmental standards, but these projects create thousands of work hours for men and women in the construction trades, which provides family-sustaining jobs, health care, and pensions for their families. Again, we appreciate the opportunity to testify on behalf of the bill and encourage members to support it. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Kayla Christensen, and then on deck is Sarah Moradine.
Hello, my name is Kayla Christensen. I'm Executive Director of the Minnesota Conservative Energy Forum, Chair Cagle, and members of the committee. The Minnesota Conservative Energy Forum is a nonprofit organization, education and advocacy organization that promotes a market-based all-of-the-above energy strategy for Minnesota. Thank you for the opportunity to testify in support of House File 342, and thank you to Representative Igoe for bringing forward this bill. This bill makes it clear in Minnesota's statute that carbon capture and sequestration is an option to be invested in and as a part of future investments. We are fortunate to live in a time where technology advances quickly, and so much so across industries that we now walk around with devices in our pockets that are more powerful than my college laptop. We will continue to see more and more similarly impactful innovations that will keep moving the energy industry forward. One of these exciting innovations is carbon capture sequestration. MNCEF advocates for an all-of-the-above approach to energy, and I can't think of a more appropriate application. We urge you to support House File 342 to put every viable option on the table in order to decarbonize. This bill does just that, putting another tool in Minnesota's toolbox to make the diverse, clean, reliable, resilient, and affordable grid of the future a reality. Thank you.
Thank you. Next up, Sarah, did I say it right?
No, but that's okay.
Can you state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony?
Thank you, Chair Cagle, committee members. My name is Sarah Meridian, and I am the Government Relations and Policy Director for CURE. CURE is a rurally based nonprofit organization dedicated to protecting and restoring resilient communities by harnessing the power of the people who care about them. Thank you for the opportunity to testify in opposition to House File 342. House File 342 is a deceptively simple bill proposing to, quote, support the development and deployment of carbon capture and sequestration technologies in Minnesota as a method of reducing greenhouse gas emissions. But carbon capture, utilization, and sequestration, or CCUS, is an unfounded strategy for decarbonization, delays an equitable clean energy transition, risks public health and safety, and provides the fossil fuel industry with a license to continue polluting. Currently, 16 CCUS facilities are in operation in the United States. These facilities are reported to have the capacity to capture up to 22 million tons of CO2 annually, but there's no evidence that any of these facilities have actually been able to achieve those goals, nor is there any example of a facility reporting a 100% capture capacity of all facility CO2 emissions. In fact, in many cases, emissions at the facility increase because of the 10 to 40% energy penalty associated with carbon capture technologies. And because CCUS technology focuses only on CO2 emissions, it does nothing to address the other pollutants that facilities emit, like nitrogen oxides, sulfur oxides, methane, mercury, arsenic, and lead. CCUS technologies are also highly water intensive and threaten water supply and quality. Furthermore, 13 of those 16 facilities send their captured CO2 to depleted oil wells for enhanced oil recovery, or EOR. As the name suggests, EOR involves injecting captured CO2 into depleted oil wells to push out oil that would have otherwise been unobtainable. Pushing more oil out of the ground is in no way compatible with our climate goals. But recent reports from North Dakota have confirmed that oil-producing states and oil companies hope to continue this trend and are in desperate need of new sources of CO2 to do so. Even if Minnesota did not intend for CO2 capture here to be used for EOR, once it leaves the state, there is little we can do to ensure that does not happen. Captured CO2 is most often transported via high-pressure pipeline. No pipeline is without risk, but CO2 pipelines are especially dangerous given the nature of CO2. CO2 is an odorless, colorless gas at atmospheric temperatures and pressures. It is denser than air, meaning it tends to settle in low-lying areas, and it also acts as an asphyxiant. So a pipeline rupture could freeze the surrounding area and could seriously injure or even suffocate those nearby. I would encourage each of you to research the 2020 rupture of a CO2 pipeline in Setarsha, Mississippi, to understand the magnitude of risk we're talking about. Past incidents and ongoing discussions by state and federal agencies underscore how ill-prepared we are to regulate CO2 pipeline safety and handle CO2 incidents. In short, blind support of CCUS technology that cannot help us achieve our climate goals is not in the best interests of Minnesota. We should not encourage corporations to line their own pockets while our rural communities shoulder the economic, environmental, and health burdens of these projects. I'd also like to note that none of the bill authors represent the communities in the footprint of the proposed route of Summit Carbon Solutions CO2 pipeline. Thank you.
Thank you. Next up is Peter Wagenius. Welcome to the committee. Do we have a page? If one of the... Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony. We've got two more testifiers, so I think we'll be okay.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm Peter Wagenius, Legislative Director of Sierra Club, the nation's oldest and largest grassroots environmental organization. Let's start with the good news. The costs of the key technologies we need for real climate action have been plummeting, and based on the studies of cost curves, they are projected to keep dropping. A recent Oxford study mentioned in the handout I just provided says that the clean energy transition is going to save us money in purely economic terms before factoring in avoided costs related to the climate and public health. And the faster we go, the more money we save. The experts who developed the Inflation Reduction Act understand this. Dr. Leah Stokes said, moving to 100% renewable energy as fast as possible and electrifying everything we can. If we do those two things alone, it can cut 3/4 of current carbon pollution. So thank you again for passing three great climate bills last year consistent with current research. Unfortunately, polluting industries are pitching carbon capture schemes as their alternative to real action. Occidental Petroleum claims that thanks to industrial carbon capture, it will someday produce net zero oil. So, quote, there's no reason not to produce oil and gas forever, unquote. Like with Occidental's, most of these schemes only partially capture carbon and are so expensive as to be unscalable. In reality, to stabilize the climate, we need to dramatically reduce polluting in multiple sectors, not just pollute marginally less through carbon capture. IPCC goals require reducing 45% by 2030 while getting on a trajectory to zero by 2050. Investments in new fossil gas infrastructure, or ethanol, are often described as bridge fuels. It is more accurate to describe them as dead-end pathways. Here's an example. The ethanol industry, The ethanol industry, in its quest for ever larger subsidies, developed a plan to partially capture carbon from their plants and ship it to North Dakota to be used for enhanced oil recovery. With this bill, we run the risk of supporting such industry plans whose primary goal is not to reduce emissions in the real world, but simply to reduce their CI scores on paper, as modeled by GREET, and secure federal subsidies through 45Q tax credits. To avoid this, I shared five key questions that should be asked before investing time or money in proposed climate solutions. To be clear, as much as Sierra Club opposes the categorical endorsement of industrial carbon capture in this bill, neither do we support a categorical rejection. It may be that after asking these five key questions, some forms of carbon capture are wise, more likely in hard to electrify sectors of heavy industry like steel and cement. But these will be the exception, not the rule, and should be treated as such. It's no comfort to say broad language in the bill is okay because it will be interpreted correctly by state agencies. As just one example, this administration clings to the outdated notion that ethanol is a climate solution. In reality, ethanol is not even a bridge fuel. It is likely 24% worse than gas, according to a recent study from the University of Wisconsin. Adding more ethanol to gasoline makes the gas more polluting, not less, and partial carbon capture only extends the economic lifespan of that problem. We would encourage you all to oppose this legislation, and thank you for the opportunity to testify.
Thank you. Next on the agenda is Ms. Sarah Wolf. If you could come to the table and state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony. And then next up will be Peg Furshong. Welcome.
Thank you so much, Chair Cagle and members of the committee. My name is Sarah Wolf. I'm Strategic Policy Director for Minnesota Interfaith Power and Light. This is a nonprofit organization of faith and spiritual communities and others around the state of Minnesota working to enact equitable climate action. So we are so thankful for the endeavors that you are pursuing. And we really appreciate the opportunity to speak about this proposal that Representative Igoe has brought forward. Appreciate the opportunity to consider the totality of carbon capture, how it is being primarily used today, and how proposals for its use are showing up in Minnesota. Our concerns are that carbon capture technologies very often enable continuing use of fossil fuels or systems that create CO2 pollution or other greenhouse gas emissions, and they do this under the guise of climate action. A Scientific American article just published last Friday is titled "The False Promise of Carbon Capture as a Climate Solution." Fossil fuel companies use captured carbon dioxide to extract more fossil fuels, which ends up having a net increase in CO2 emissions. These kinds of practices, as prior testifiers have spoken about, require nuance and great depth of understanding in each particular project to ensure that the goals that we are seeking might be met. We are concerned that the promises of carbon capture so far have not been lived up to. We are concerned that it requires billions and billions of taxpayer dollars to support these industries. Those dollars could be better spent to other climate solutions that are proven. And we are mainly concerned that in Minnesota now, these projects are showing up in a way of encouraging the building out of a network of carbon capture and CO2 pipelines. And these pipelines are very damaging, both in their construction and hazardous in their operation. I know that a subsequent speaker will speak to some of these dangers, but it's of great concern. And if we look at the history of building pipelines in Minnesota recently, we find that aquifers, multiple aquifers have been breached, and that the drilling practices for putting in pipelines left 63% of the waters crossed polluted. As prior testifiers have noted, the vast majority of projects operating in the United States today are taking this captured CO2 to oil wells for enhanced oil recovery. And this is what creates the hindrance and the problem of sustaining the fossil fuels industry that we need to be moving away from. Might carbon capture be useful in some situations? I think that is that's a possibility. But this, again, requires deep nuance and deep understanding of the technology and the proposals being proposed. Minnesota Interfaith Power and Light is very concerned about creating networks of pipelines that will damage communities and the land and the air and ultimately be counterproductive to our goals. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Last on the agenda, then, is Ms. Peg Bershong. I hope I say that right. Welcome to the committee. If you could please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Good morning. My name is Peg Fershawn, and I'm here from Renville County this morning. I'm a landowner, and I've actively been involved with the current proposed CO2 pipeline infrastructure project in Minnesota from Summit Carbon Solutions in Iowa. And for the past 2 years, I have done my best to learn as much about this as possible because the proposed project is slated to be at the foot of my driveway. I'm a parent, I'm an educator, and farming has been part of our family for multiple generations. I appreciate the opportunity to share with you some of the concerns we have about House File 342. As stated, House File 342 broadly supports the development and deployment of carbon capture sequestering technologies in Minnesota as a method for reducing greenhouse gas emissions in order to achieve the state's greenhouse gas emission reduction goals as established in under Section 216H.102, Subdivision 1. The bill implies that carbon capture technology will reduce greenhouse gas emissions, and this simply is not true. In fact, it does just the opposite. It actually incentivizes farmers to continue growing corn and the production of ethanol. I think you need to keep in mind that for every gallon of ethanol we produce, that is mixed with 8 or 9 gallons of fossil fuel, gasoline, creating gasoline, which just adds to our greenhouse gas emission burden. The process of capturing CO2 at the ethanol plant is highly energy and water intensive. It actually takes more energy to convert the CO2 gas to a liquid so that it can be transported in the pipeline. This process of distilling and compressing the gas is done at extremely high temperatures and requires actually more water to capture the carbon than it does to make ethanol. The industry would like you to believe that CCS will actually lower the carbon intensity score of ethanol, but because of the significant amounts of energy and water needed to facilitate the CCS process, it actually increases the carbon footprint significantly. For more than 2 decades, the federal government has pumped billions of dollars into research on CCS, and the fact that 85% of these projects have failed and shuttered, and the handful that are still operating are only doing so with subsidies from the federal government and taxpayers. I caution you not to rush into a situation where Minnesota becomes a pilot project for a public for-profit company to make money at the expense of taxpayers once again. Beyond this not being a well-thought-out strategy for reducing greenhouse gas emissions, there are risks to rural communities. The Pipeline Hazardous Materials Safety Administration has recognized that their guidelines do not address the risks associated with CO2 pipelines and have actively been working to update their safety standards and guidelines. I would strongly encourage you to look at what this infrastructure needs to operate before we begin building an infrastructure such as this. I would require these companies to be much more transparent with their energy and water demands. The proposed 28.5-mile stretch in Ottertail and Wilkin County estimates an additional 12 million gallons of water a year to run the Fergus Falls plant's carbon capture process. Summit Carbon Solutions currently has contracts with five other ethanol plants in the 10-county proposed footprint of Minnesota, with the potential for three additional plants. If I've done my math correctly, we can expect a demand for an additional 72 to 100 million gallons of water a year. And in 2023, we had communities in the proposed footprint that didn't even have enough water for their municipal freshwater drinking needs. This bill will prioritize an extractionist industry over rural Minnesotans and puts our freshwater and groundwater drinking supply, our freshwater and groundwater supplies at risk. Lastly, Minnesota does not have the geology required to sequester CO2 within our borders. If this CCS infrastructure is built in Minnesota, we have no assurances that the CO2 will be extracted will stay in the ground. The race for the 45Q dollars at the federal level is really just a carbon Ponzi scheme. We have no assurances that the CO2 will stay after the 45Q incentives sunset. While you may have the best intentions of addressing greenhouse gas emissions, the impacts are too great for rural Minnesota. This is a huge investment of Minnesota taxpayer dollars, and these dollars could be better used at addressing our climate concerns. I want to thank you, Representative Cagle, and the committee for allowing me to testify today, and I'd be happy to answer any questions you may have.
Thank you very much. Is there anybody from the public wishing to testify? All right, with that, we will move on to member discussion. Anybody have questions? Representative Kraft?
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Igoe. So I appreciate you teeing up a discussion here. As I read through the words, that seems to be about trying to assist in the climate challenges that we face. So I appreciate that. And so I want to engage on a few questions. I share some of the concerns that have been raised, but I want to start by, digging in a little bit. Because you mentioned in your discussion of carbon sequestration and, planting trees. So one of the things that I don't see here is there's a lot of things that can be carbon capture and sequestration. Trees, forest preservation, peat preservation, prairie restoration, regenerative agriculture. So what is your definition of it? In this.
Representative Igoe.
Thank you, Chair and Representative Kraft. So I kept the language in the bill very simple for that reason, so we can encompass as many things as possible, right? Because another form of carbon capture and sequestration is this desk we're all sitting around right now, right? So development and deployment of carbon capture and sequestration technologies, as long as we could find a way to cooperate in that we are either taking carbon out of that system or sequestering carbon from entering our atmosphere, those are things that are going to help our climate goals and make Minnesota better and our world better. That was the idea of doing it that way.
Representative Kraft.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Igoe, so appreciate that. So, one of the other things that you mentioned was that the University of Minnesota, I think, got tens of millions of dollars, and other companies have gotten grants to study some of the things that you're talking about. Mm-hmm. So what is keeping us from doing that? Why do we need this? Because it seems like there's research happening, there's stuff happening. So what's preventing us from doing this? Why is this necessary?
Representative Igoe.
Madam Chair and Representative. So right now, we have our universities and some companies doing research and, finding out what exactly we can do with what. The reason I want the bill there, and I think we need the bill there as a state, is so our state agencies, if we need to create policy around that in the future, or we need to work with companies, because we don't know, you know, you put something in the ground, take something out of the ground. There's a lot of rules around that as a state. And right now we have no laws on the books that are going to allow the state of Minnesota to be able to work with those companies or institutions to find ways to make sure it's all legal and up to code. So I wanted to give an outlet to the state of Minnesota that there is an avenue for us to go to work in that, and our state agencies could get to work.
Representative Kraft?
Madam Chair, Representative Igo, so thank you. So, you know, one of my concerns about putting something like this is that, you know, some aspects of this, depending on the where you're talking, are very costly. If you look at the data on it, that it would wind up with increased cost of power and increased cost of other things. So I don't see, I mean, given that there's stuff happening, and I'd also say, you know, we'd be putting our thumb on the scale and saying, okay, we should be doing this versus why don't we do it for thermal energy or other, you know, other kinds of things. So, you know, given the cost concerns on this and the fact that it's so broad, I just don't see the need for us to do this. That there's investigation happening in some of the areas you're talking about. There's some real concerns and real health concerns and cost concerns. So I think we should just let the things that we're doing play out. Thank you, Representative Mike.
Did you want to respond at all?
I'll respond to that briefly.
Sure.
Madam Chair, Representative, I appreciate the conversation, and I also appreciate kind of the committee as a whole hearing this bill today, because this is what the legislature is all about. We're supposed to sit around a table and talk about bills and share our concerns. In regards to your comments there, again, we've been hearing for the last couple of years we need to be able to do everything we can to combat climate change. And one thing we talked about in Energy Committee last week is how Minnesota makes up 0.002% of global emissions. So the point of a bill like this is that if we could have industries that are going carbon negative and allow the state to work with companies to do that, then we're actually going to start having an impact as the state of Minnesota. But if we eliminate carbon emissions right now, we're not going to do anything. We're 0.002%. One coal plant in China is going to emit more NOx, SOx, and CO2 into the atmosphere than anything here in Minnesota, because we have good regulations. So I think if we're going to try and combat this crisis, we're going to try and be leaders, whether it's in industry, whether it's in jobs, whether it's in energy, we got to give Minnesota the toolbox to go to work.
Representative, yeah, one more. Madam Chair, Representative Igo. So what I would say is we do need to do things here. And one of the things I'm very interested in is in carbon negative steel, right? Mm-hmm. So, and I think there are really some interesting paths to get there. My concern with putting something like this in is that it leads us down a path that's more costly, that's not effective. So I don't think, you know, putting our thumb on the scale with this, I want to go and figure that out, but not biasing us to a way that just may not be the most cost effective or the healthiest way to do it. So, thank you.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I kind of feel we're back in the Ag Committee this morning with the general bashing of corn here.
You know how I feel.
Representative Kraft mentioned alternative ways to sequester carbon. And yeah, I'm a farmer, and I've been told or read and heard that the ultimate perfect solar panel is a corn plant. It takes in CO2, gives off oxygen. In fact, the Midwest in the middle of July has been compared to the Amazon rainforest, with the corn out in the entire Midwest of the country doing a good job of sequestering carbon and giving off oxygen. Some other comments, testimony I've heard, that because of renewable energy, the price of electricity is going down. Well, I'd like to find out where that would be. Electricity costs are going up fairly quickly. We had grocery store folks in here yesterday, and one grocery store man said, we've put in all kinds of energy-efficient coolers, walk-in coolers and such with doors, and really decrease our energy usage, yet his electric bill has gone up by, I can't remember the number, but 20% in the last couple of years because of the increased cost of electricity. A lot of that pertains to having to back up renewable energy with baseload power. It was mentioned that ethanol industry is getting ever larger subsidies, I think it was Mr. Wagenius, and I would like to ask him what subsidies he's talking about that they're getting currently, and they're looking for ever larger subsidies. I just don't think that, I'm not aware of that, if that's the case. If he could tell us which subsidies ethanol plants are currently getting here in Minnesota, I'd like to hear that.
Mr. Wagenius, if you could make your way up and just state your name again.
I don't have the years in front of me, but the 45Q preceded the Inflation Reduction Act and was increased as part of the Inflation Reduction Act. I want to be clear as I say that Sierra Club, and I love the Inflation Reduction Act. I think it's an awesome piece of legislation in total, but there were problematic provisions, and that was probably the biggest one. 45Q was already incentivizing ethanol production and is now doing, as it was increased, I think $85 is now the, it's even more than it was in the past. So that would be one example.
Representative Anderson?
And that's what's driving all this. And this came from the administration in Washington, $85 a ton. That's what's going to pay for all of this if it's ever done. Came from the Biden administration, and you're correct about those 45Z RINs, which is an extremely complicated system. And where they're being utilized is in California, Oregon, and Washington, the states that have the low-carbon fuel standards, and the plants that are able to sustain a carbon intensity score, I believe 50 or under, are able to sell into those markets because of the policies from Washington with the great money out there for our carbon reduction plants. So, you know, we're talking about a lot of things here, and I just, you know, we're, some people bash ethanol, but we believe that it is a way to the future, a gateway, not a dead end. And those are my feelings. And some of these areas, it helps rural Minnesota, the industries out there, the environment and such. And I'm a supporter of that. And because of some of the policies from Washington, these things are being talked about. Methane digesters, things like that, all possible because of the money flowing out of Washington. It's probably borrowed money that is going to pay for some of these things in the quest of reducing carbon.
Thank you, Representative Anderson. And I'm going to follow up with that, you and I forming the coalition of renewable fuels. next on the list is Representative Ream.
Thank you, Chair Cagle, and thank you, Representative Igo, for bringing this bill forward so that we can talk about it. I did do some research on carbon capture sequestration. Very interesting to find out about the public health and safety risks. And I don't know if you've read much about them, but I did read that the pipelines are vulnerable to rupture. And there was that case in Mississippi that caused quite the emergency. And I think it happened a couple years ago. And I think it's a case study in what we need to be aware of if we're thinking about doing this kind of, you know, this kind of pipeline, which honestly, the testifier from Hawk Creek Prairie Farm who talked about her land being taken over, I mean, I think that's a real concern. I think we all need to be very aware that that's not something we would want to do. We wouldn't want to use eminent domain to take over people's land, especially, you know, for something that's very risky. But yeah, the public health and safety risks, I think, are very real. I think we need to really look at that. What I'm reading, too, is that when it does leak, it's odorless, it's invisible, it pools in valleys, it pools in people's basements. And in the emergency that happened in Mississippi, there was an article about it, and it said in one 911 call, a mother pleaded for help because her daughter couldn't breathe, her hacking audible in the background. Another 911 caller, stranded on the highway, described what was happening to her friend. She's laying on the ground, and she's shaking. She's kind of drooling out of the mouth. I don't know if she's having a seizure or not. Can you send somebody quick? So then it goes on to say that humans always breathe some carbon dioxide, but too much causes a thirst for oxygen, disorientation, and heart malfunction. Extreme exposures to carbon dioxide can lead to death by asphyxiation. The use of carbon dioxide to kill pigs is now under scrutiny over whether it complies with federal laws on humane slaughter. So, I mean, I think we need to look at a number of things, but for me, the public health and safety risk is too great, and I would not support this legislation. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Remuth. I hope we have better regulations than Mississippi, though. So, Representative Igo?
I'll just respond to that briefly. You know, no industry is without risk, and that's not to minimize any of those things you talked about, right? They're horrible instances. But I guarantee you when a solar panel is getting put up and a wind turbine is getting up, right, people get hurt too. I mean, that's industry that's moving life forward, and we can't just put the stop on something because of that. We can do better and we can move forward. And like the chair said, we're Minnesota, right? We do things a lot better. I also want to add, you know, you talk about the eminent domain thing. I share the concern. It's all about local control and making sure we take care of landowner rights. Then I hope we can work together on maybe stopping some of the solar expansion all of our prime farmland, right? So we can't have it one way or the other. If we're going to talk about all of it, let's talk about all of them. So that's just my response to that. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Igo. Representative Acom. Oh, I'm sorry, Representative Ream. I didn't see you back.
Yeah, if I could respond to that. Sure. Thank you, Chair Cagle and Spencer, Representative Igo. So when farmers decide to put solar panels on their fields, that's a decision that they make. It helps diversify their income. I know a lot of people who are very happy to have the wind turbines and the solar panels on their farm fields. This is different. This is Carbon Solutions taking over people's land without them having a say in what goes under, you know, on their land. So that's a completely different situation, and I'd like to point that out. Thank you.
Representative Acom.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I just want to start out by complimenting Representative Igo for hearing in committee that we were talking about how important it is that we do everything we can to address climate change. And I think the important piece there is that we need to do things that are proven and will actually decrease emissions overall. We've heard today from testifiers, and the science shows that that isn't necessarily happening. And so to have a state policy that supports the development and deployment of carbon capture is it doesn't feel like the appropriate path when what we are trying to do is be effective in the costs that we're making, making responsible investments in proven technologies that can actually move the dial. And so I've heard some other comments that have been made, and I don't want to respond to them all, but I think that we know that we need to reduce emissions, and we know that we need to do it in a timely way. I don't think that having a state policy that supports this at this point, it just doesn't make sense to me given all of the risks to our communities around the state. So thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Igo?
Just a quick response, because I know we're probably getting to the end here. Again, this is about making sure we have all the tools in our toolbox to do the work on this. I mean, sure, we talked a lot about the pipelines around CO2 today, but it's much larger and grander than that. And I don't want that to get lost in this discussion, because it is about the forest products industry. Yeah, it is about the steel industry. It's about the taconite industry. There's way more industries in this. And if we really want to talk about having a limited carbon economy, we're going to need to do these things, because there's products that we have to design that are carbon intensive, and we're going to have to find ways to minimize it. That's why the federal government is putting hundreds of thousands of millions of dollars into programs to try and offset those costs, and for states to step up and take the stand and say, we're going to find a way to do this right. So I think shying away from a challenge is not the way that we should be acting for our constituents and their future.
Representative Anderson.
Madam Chair, thanks for your indulgence, and I guess I'm kind of on a roll today here. But anyway, just a couple of comments on things that has been said or that have been said. I think what I've read so far, about 80% of the easements have been secured for the Summit pipeline. And yeah, those that have not signed easements, I share your concern if you don't want it. You know, that's your right. But a lot of the easements have been secured. It was mentioned that a solar community solar garden is different from what we're talking about today. And it was mentioned about having a thumb on the scale. You know, the reason these solar gardens are being put up on farmland is because the payments being made to the landowners are many times higher than what they could get from renting it out for planting a crop. I've heard upwards of $1,000 to $1,500 an acre per year on a 20-year lease, and that's because we have, or somebody's put their thumb on the scale and made that that lucrative. And we talked about siting of power lines and such. It makes me think about the power lines compared to pipelines. I think Representative Kraft has legislation that would streamline the siting of power lines because we need more of them to bring in more renewable energy in the state. And again, you know, some people feel about power lines like other people may feel about pipelines. There's one coming in my area. There have been meetings throughout the winter, a lot of people expressing concern about it, but we're told that's the first of many power lines to be built to bring in renewable power from wherever the wind may be blowing. So just my thoughts, my comments. We are talking about energy, about reducing carbon, which is a good thing. We all agree to that. But just some comments I have on thumbs on the scale and things like that as we work through these things here in Minnesota.
Representative Hornstein.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just wanted to ask Ms. Maradian if, in fact, our regulations are better than other states.
Thank you, Sarah Maradian, again, for CURE. Thank you for the question. Sorry, Chair Cagle, Representative Hornstein. So actually, the federal government, the Pipeline and Hazardous Materials Safety Administration, or PHMSA for short, is the agency that's charged with regulating the safety measurements around pipelines. And so we have the exact same regulations as Mississippi when it comes to pipeline safety. And concerningly, I think I referenced this in my original testimony, PHMSA has said that it needs to update its rules specifically around CO2 pipelines in terms of how they are built, how they're managed, how they operate, but also in terms of emergency management, in part because of what happened in Mississippi. And so rulemaking has not begun yet, but it's anticipated to get underway, I think, in quarter one of this year.
So you're saying that we're not better than Mississippi?
I am saying exactly those words, Chair Cagle.
That's really wrong. Any follow-up, Chair Hornstein?
No, that's that was my assumption, so thank you.
Thank you. Any further discussion to the bill? Representative, we've got 10 minutes left, so I'm going to keep this going as long as we got questions.
This will be super. Thank you, Madam Chair. I've said I want, but if Representative Anderson wants to sign on to my bill, it actually is about using right-of-way so you don't have to disturb more landowners. So please sign on.
All right, Representative Igoe, closing comment.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And again, I appreciate the vibrant discussion we had today. You know, this is why it's good to hear minority bills. We can do this more often. but I just kind of want to summarize what this is all about today. This is about giving the opportunity and tools to Minnesotan businesses and Minnesota as a whole to be a leader on this. You know, we can hear about bad stories happening around us, and I think we can't let, when we hear a bad news article or when we see something going on that we don't like, we can't shy away from that just because we don't like it somewhere else. If you want to be leaders, if Minnesota wants to be different, if Minnesota wants to be on the global stage as a state that's doing things right, we'll find the way to get it done right, and we have found the way to get it done right in the past. Right. I mean, imagine we could have, you know, one of my testifiers that was here today, we could have the trades building out this technology, this infrastructure that's going to do it. We could have Minnesota Chamber businesses that are finding ways to make carbon neutral and carbon negative products that we could export from Minnesota while providing those carbon free jobs. That, and we could put Minnesota on the map, not for being carbon neutral by 2040, but carbon negative. And then the issues that we're seeing about, that we talk about in other committees around here about how we're, you know, the climate change has run away because of other carbon places, and we got to find a way to limit that. Minnesota could be negative to help with that situation. These are the ideas that we need to have and the tough conversations we need to have. We can't shy away just because we see some negative and say, oh, not that, not today. And I think the point of sustainable infrastructure is for us to take a bold stand and for us to get involved. And this policy, I mean, I need to say it's 12 lines the whole bill as it sits. And it doesn't give out any money. It doesn't put the thumb on the scale. It just says that Minnesota and its state agencies are going to work with companies and work with people to find solutions. And I think everyone in this room believes we should have solutions. So I encourage the committee to continue to learn about it, and I would welcome any conversations we can have, because with this, we can provide good jobs, we can provide a sustainable future, and we can really lead the way as Minnesotans. So thank you again for the hearing, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Igoe. And I also appreciate the very thoughtful questions and discussion around this, and I do hope we can do it again. So with that, I will lay over House File 342. And then with that, we have kind of given up our committee time now to some of the finance committees because we know time is really tight this year. And I feel that we've gotten our work accomplished. So if there is any other informational hearings or, hearings that we need to pull together, I will notify you. But I just I want to thank you guys all for indulging me in this little quest of sustainable infrastructure. My intent was always to have this as a one-term committee. So because we are in this moment in time where we are having a lot of infrastructure dollars flow into our state. And so I just really want to thank you guys for having an interest in this and for having great discussions on the committee. And if there's anything further, we will do the next meeting at the call of the chair. So with that, our meeting is adjourned. Thank you.